Please be seated. Except for Justice Kroski, she may remain standing because she has some back issues and is better served by standing. So thank you for that. Personally, it's just the way it is sometimes, right? Colleen State versus Ryan Hugh Mulhern. This is 19 AP 1565. Could I have your appearances, please? All right, good morning. The lineup I have is 25 minutes, followed by 30, followed by 5 minutes in rebuttal. Okay, with that, let's proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Ryan Mulhern sexually assaulted Lisa, the victim in this case. The Court of Appeals undid his conviction for sexual assault because of a single statement that the state elicited from Lisa denying that she had sex with anyone else the week before the assault. Current case law based on unexamined concessions provides that evidence of lack of sexual conduct is inadmissible rape shield evidence. And in light of the Court of Appeals holding that the error in admitting Lisa's statement here was not harmless, this case reflects a troubling result where the operation of a statute created to help sexual assault victims is vacating a jury verdict and requiring Lisa to relive her trauma in a new trial. In effect, it's acting as a sword, not a shield.
So are you asking us to overturn Bell, Gavigan, Mitchell, and other cases in which I thought we made it clear that this type of evidence was not admissible?
I think what we're asking is that you hold that reading sub 2A of the statute, which this court has never done, the acceptance of the lack of sexual conduct, meaning sexual conduct, started with a concession in Clark. It followed with a concession in Gavigan. Neither of those cases examined it. It continued in Mitchell, and Bell, again, sort of repeated the concession. I mean, everyone sort of went along accepting that this was the case, but there's no cases from this court actually looking at 2A.
So you don't think we would be overturning those cases?
It would be overturning. I mean, I think it would be... I don't think you have to overturn those cases because it wouldn't change the result, but I think it would be removing language from those cases. Now, if that's overturning, then yes. But
Counsel, I just want to push back a little bit. I understand the point. Maybe there was not a briefed in a certain way in the past, but even in Gavigan, Gavigan says the state concedes a trial court erred in admitting into evidence these direct references to Essie's virginity. We agree. Mm-hmm. The statute precludes the admission of any evidence pertaining to a complainant's prior sexual conduct or reputation. Nothing in the statute limits its applicability to prior affirmative acts, and goes on from there. That it certainly reads to me like much more than a concession. It's a concession plus a stamp of approval on that. I'd like you to respond to that. I'd also like you to respond to the relevance of the fact that, you know, after the fact, the legislature goes in and partially overturns, I guess, some of the way this court handled the admission of this evidence and how that might relate to the analysis.
Sure. So when I read Gavigan, the court still talked about focus on 2B. And that says any evidence concerning the complaining witness's prior sexual conduct. The focus on any evidence in that section never went back. The court never went back to look at 2A. The state never, you know, and again, this was the state's concession. We acknowledge that, there's reasons for that. But I don't think we've ever looked at 2A. To say that you're agreeing with the concession doesn't necessarily mean that you've looked at all the arguments. It could be that, you know, we accept it based on 2B and the arguments before us. And as this court knows, you generally don't want to decide issues on arguments not made. So there's that. In relation to your question on why would the legislature respond to Gavigan on one part and not the other, if they were concerned about, if am I that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
I don't think you can read too much into the legislature's change. What they were concerned with in Gavigan was that the court was taking evidence that it considered rape shield evidence, and it was creating an exception within the statute outside the statute. And I think that was the larger concern. The fact that the evidence here was virginity evidence, I mean, sure, you could read that the legislature said, yes, that should be rape shield evidence, but it also could mean they just weren't paying attention to that part of it, or they were considering that, you know, again, it wasn't a big part of the decision in Gavigan, and, you know, it just could be something that they weren't all that concerned about, or maybe they just didn't foresee that this sort of evidence would be a problem in cases. So that they responded to one part of the decision, not another, I don't think is dispositive of what the legislature thought.
Why is this, address harmless error, if you would.
Sure. So, you know, and this, the harmless error analysis is a little bit awkward because, and honestly, this is kind of sort of why I'm asking the court to look at the whole statute, because normally when we look at harmless error, we have an error. We have evidence that came in that was clearly irrelevant, that was possibly prejudicial. In this case, this evidence was relevant. It's not prejudicial. And so we're kind of going through these motions of saying, well, what would the case look like without this error, even though it's probably not really an error. But the factors we look at, the strength of the case and the nature of the case. So the state had a strong case here. The Court of Appeals called it a he said, she said, and again, I don't like that phrase. It was, there was an element of credibility there. But Lisa's claims had backup and physical evidence. She had tear to her labia. She had an abrasion in her vagina. These were discovered the day of the assault. She was examined by an experienced nurse practitioner who said these were consistent with sexual assault. She had bruising, tenderness on the thighs. She reported right away. We didn't see some of the features that we often see in sexual assault, like reporting inconsistencies in the statement. She had a consistent story the entire time. She reported it right away. She reported it to police, to friends, to a rape support system, to, around. It was the same story every time. She had no motivation to fabricate the assaults. And she gave really compelling testimony about, what happened from beginning to end about
this. But how compelling is it when the jury found not guilty on a couple of the charges?
Well, they found not guilty on strangulation.
Yeah, that's right.
And I wouldn't read too deeply into a jury finding not guilty on strangulation. This happens a lot. It is not at all unusual for a jury to split a verdict on a sexual assault and strangulation. And why is that?
It's because they don't believe her total rendition. I don't know why, but let me ask. Do you find it of any import whatsoever that they found not guilty on the strangulation charge?
If it was any other charge, Your Honor, I think it would have possibly more weight. So, for example, say she said two assaults happened and they find guilty on one and not on the other. Strangulation is an incredibly difficult conviction for prosecutors to get, and it's not just in Wisconsin. It's all over. It is a relatively new crime. Juries tend to have a hard time. And I don't know exactly what it is. I looked and looked for...
But Attorney Brigandy, was there an expert that was called in this case to explain to the jury regarding strangulation?
Was there, I'm sorry...
Was there an expert called to testify about the strangulation charge?
The only testimony on strangulation, I believe, came from the same nurse who testified, and there was testified as to the injuries and how they matched up on kind of a, there was a strangulation checklist that she had, and you know, some things were checked, some things weren't. She had bruising around her neck and tenderness, but didn't see the types of injuries that sometimes you see, like the broken blood vessels or, you know, some of the more, like, out there, you know, just things beyond bruising. And I will note that defense counsel did a really, you know, strong job in his closing argument, kind of pointing out or trying to urge the jury to look at those injuries and say that's just really not enough. And, you know, I think, you know, so we can chalk it up to strong arguments by counsel. It could be that the jury wanted to see something different. They wanted to see hands and not an arm. They wanted to hear more about how she passed out. You know, I mean, and there's a lot. And if I could understand why juries tend to not convict on strangulation, I would be doing probably something different. But I don't think there's a lot we can take from that.
When you were addressing Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, she asked you about harmless error, and you talked about the strength and nature of the state's case. You talked about the physical injuries to the victim. You talked about the fact that she reported right away that her story was consistent and that she didn't have any motivation to fabricate. Was there anything about the testimony of the defendant that we should consider? You know, you mentioned some things in your brief, and reading through parts of the transcript, it looks like he had to be rehabilitated a number of times with his cell phone or with text messages that had been taken off his cell phone.
Absolutely. Well, his testimony was fairly inconsistent. He got onto the stand and said, you know, she invited me over. The prosecutor came in and said, well, let's look at the text messages. And then he says, oh, no, actually, it was more me asking to come over. No. And the prosecutor said, did you, you know, he said, I just came over and things just sort of happened. And I didn't see any objection from her. We started kissing. We talked a little bit about my girlfriend, but that was it. But what was missing is really, I mean, there was one thing that the prosecutor crossed on was that there were a number of text messages that went between Lisa and him before, in which she made clear a number of times she didn't want sex. She just wanted to be friends. If he was going to come over, it was just going to be as friends. Another thing that he didn't remember on the stand was whether he had told her about having problems that he needed to talk about or that there were other worries on his mind. Again, he had to backtrack on that when he was shown text messages describing that he was having a nervous breakdown and that he, you know, had really wanted to talk to her about a lot of things. I mean, and then otherwise, reading his testimony, it really, really struck me that it was so tailored to the evidence that the state had that it stopped resembling how humans actually interact with each other. In other words, if this was a spontaneous sexual encounter between two people, it really looked a lot more like something that somebody would be trying to do so that he could later testify that a rape didn't happen, or trying to testify that he only touched these parts and not those parts, and so that he could have some sort of explanation for it. You know, and a lot of this is just, you know, these are soft factors, but just keep in mind, this is what the jury's hearing. I mean, we have just this transcript saying this happened, that happened, that happened, but the jury's hearing all of these things, you know, and weighing against each other.
There's two things that are, I guess, bothering me when it comes to harmless error, and hopefully I'm going to ask you to address them. The first is the fact that the defense was not allowed to ask any questions to cross on the issue of whether she had sex with anyone else during the week. So it was left there with an inability to cross-examine. It was let in by one side but not by the other. I don't know what that would have led to, but it's there, mm-hmm. And it's bothersome to me. And the other piece that's bothersome to me is that it wasn't just the one statement, which may not be that big of a deal, in a harmless error analysis, but there was the extent to which the prosecution argued it at closing. And I was trying to pull up the transcript. I couldn't reach it quickly. But there's a nice section there on how important DNA is, that it was male DNA, and how important it was that she said she had sex with no one else that week. So
right.
Can you address both of those, please?
Sure. So as to whether that he was not permitted to, I think you phrased it, he wasn't permitted to cross her on that. I don't think that's quite right. I think he could have questioned her on it if he had evidence that it wasn't true. I think he made a comment saying, in any event,
didn't she have a boyfriend or something? I don't know. There was something in the transcript. No.
No, that wasn't there.
Okay.
No, I think it came in. The discussion was during trial. I think he made a comment that we think there might be something, and I have an objection. And the court said, we'll just go on with it. And that never came up again. So, I mean, we're here now. There isn't an objection saying, hey, I had evidence. There isn't an issue here saying I had evidence that I wanted to get in and I could have gotten in and this violated my due process rights. But I think the key on that, Your Honor, is the state, I think, and I think this illustrates sort of why barring this evidence outright is a problem. So here the state puts in this DNA evidence showing a partial result of male DNA in her vagina. Even if Lisa hadn't testified that she hadn't had sex in the days 5 days before, say that you only have evidence that it would only stay there for 5 days and it's there. If he had evidence that she had had a sexual partner in those 5 days, Pulitzano would give him a means to get that in. So it works for defendants to get this evidence in. He would have to argue that it happened and it's relevant and meet those steps. But there's not a way for the state, if the rape shield statute says this doesn't come in, there's not seemingly a way for the state to get that in to say, no, she didn't have sex with anybody in those days and to prove its case. So that's that question. The prosecutor's remarks is your second question.
Right.
I think when you take the prosecutor's remarks, just looking at them as they're sort of stated in the brief, it seems like that's what they leaned on. It wasn't. The prosecutor's closing was 12 pages long, led with the strongest evidence. That was the tear to the labia, the abrasions to the vagina. This against a defendant who said, we only kissed and I only touched her above the waist. In his main closing, there's one paragraph he talks about, yes, so we have this DNA evidence. The expert said 5 days. She said she didn't have sex. The inference is that it's his. The part where he talks about it being important, the timeline being important, that's all in response to the defense closing. So he's just responding to that part where the defense is suggesting, this partial DNA isn't consistent with the way she said things happened. You would expect much more to be there. You would expect it to be identifiable. We just can't really trust it. And so really all the prosecutor was doing was responding to that. But again, the prosecutor returned to the tear to the labia, the abrasions to the vagina. I mean, this is just the type of physical evidence, again, we don't a lot of times aren't able to see in these sexual assault cases against a defendant saying everything was above the waist. I just kissed her. We just touched. And that was it. I had no touching down there. So I think that's really the key in the harmless error argument.
Attorney Burgundy, in your brief, one of the things that you argue regarding harmless error is that the timeline would have been the same with or without this evidence. Can you walk me through that reasoning? That the timeline would have been the same.
The timeline would have been the same without the evidence?
I thought that's what you wrote. That's what I wrote down that you wrote. Yeah, that the timeline regarding, the way I understood it was that the sexual assault happened, that she still went and had the same exam 12 hours later, and that evidence, that all would have come in even if you didn't have the evidence regarding her lack of sexual activity 5 days prior.
Right. I mean, well, the state would have still admitted. I mean, both parties wanted the partial DNA results in there. I mean, I think that it all would have been in there. And I think Vincent Purpura's statement that it would normally clear after 5 days still would have been in there. So really that's the only piece that would have gone in. And I guess, again, on the harmless error, in you know, one of my kind of questions with the Court of Appeals' decision is that the evidence that she didn't have sex 5 days before is just her testimony that she didn't have sex 5 days before. It is not, it's something the jury could choose to disbelieve if they want to. You know, I think we're going back to, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley's question about, well, why, you know, if perhaps they didn't believe her on the sexual assault, if they didn't believe her on the strangulation, well, why, you know, why would that be, why would her statement that she had sex 5 days before be the thing that said, you know, that pushed them over when, you know, again, they're free to believe or not believe anything that she's saying. And if they think she's lying about the sexual assault, why believe her on the 5 day prior question? But again, I mean, I do want to emphasize that, and I understand that we are working from case law in which you said that this evidence doesn't come in, and it would be a lot easier, probably. I mean, it's a lot simpler to resolve this case on harmless error. Why are we asking you to change the law? This is going to come up again. I mean, at the time that we decided these cases in which virginity came in, number one, there wasn't, DNA evidence wasn't really a thing yet. We didn't really see how and why this type of evidence would come in. I think at the time that Clark, Gavigan, Mitchell were decided, it was looked at as this is just really never going to be relevant. It's always harmless error. We can always, you know, resolve on those grounds. But the problem with just always resolving on harmless error is that it leaves courts with this sort of untenable problem of saying, okay, well, we have this relevant evidence. It would inform the DNA evidence. It's not prejudicial. The law says I can't put it in, so we kind of have to just put it to the jury to maybe speculate about what happened before, and then hope, you know, either they do that or they let it in by mistake, as they did here, and then we're stuck telling victims, well, yeah, your conviction might be reversed in a year in harmless error grounds, or having to rely on the appellate courts to apply harmless error. And that really just shouldn't be how it works.
Counsel, could you expound on your argument under Polizano? Because as I understand it, if we accept your construction of the statute of 2A, then this evidence could come in. But that does open the door, does it not, for the defendant to rebut, if he can, the testimony that was proffered about her not having had sex in the week before. Is it your argument that Polizano would allow the defendant to then rebut that evidence?
Right. If the defendant could meet the standard under Polizano, then it would come in. And you know, normally this would come in as a pretrial decision, like any other pretrial evidentiary decision. So the state would put in a motion saying, this is coming in. The defendant could put in the motion based on, you know, Polizano, other constitutional claims. There are a couple of Court of Appeals cases, Gulrud and Wirtz, that talked kind of about that scenario where, you know, defendant has evidence that would normally be barred by the rape shield that the state has opened the door to, the defendant could use Polizano. So, yes, would the rule possibly open the door if a prosecutor enters this evidence? It could. I just don't think it would be open very much wider than it already is in terms of a defendant getting in relevant evidence that would normally be barred under the rape shield.
Is Polizano's holding kind of, I don't want to call it an end run around the rape shield statute, but they created this balancing test, as I read it, I think trying to reconcile other
evidentiary rules, is it fair to say then that the Rape Shield statute is not this hard and fast rule, that it is subject to balancing with other evidentiary rules?
No, I mean, the legislature said what it said after Gavigan. I mean, if you have Rape Shield evidence and it doesn't fit within the three exceptions, and if it isn't, admittable under Polizzano, it stays out. But I think, you know what Polizzano is looking at is there's, defendant has due process rights to compulsory process and confrontation, and so that's what that's getting at. But that's where the imbalance really is, that the statute's really designed at keeping out the evidence that defendants, for a long time have been trying to get in these sexual assault trials. It wasn't really aimed at the state not being able to introduce relevant evidence to support an element of the crime. And so the balance seems to be going, if Polizzano is sort of I wouldn't call it an end run, but maybe an escape hatch for when constitutional rights are implicated by, pieces of evidence that might otherwise be barred. But again, the statute shouldn't be working against victims to prevent the state from admitting evidence that's relevant. Thank you.
May it please the court. I believe that words mean something, that they're not to be twisted and turned until they mean what you would like them to mean or what you might wish them to mean, or in this case, what the state might wish these words to mean, which is why we're here today. Unhappy with not getting the usual workaround from the Court of Appeals for the improper admission of Rape Shield evidence, it now asks this court to take a fresh look at a decision from nearly 40 years ago. And I would submit there's no need for a fresh look because of the plain meaning of that statute in question as found by this court all those years ago. But even if the court were to do so, I would say that the state has failed to demonstrate any ambiguity in the plain language of the statute that would require a withdrawal of the court's original interpretation of the statute. Plain meaning is a simple concept. As this court has stated in the past, statutory interpretation begins with the language of the statute. If the meaning of the statute is plain, we ordinarily stop the inquiry. That is from Mr. Kalel, whose name was pronounced differently last week when I was watching some arguments, but I...
It's Kalel.
Kalel, okay.
The first A is it's a hard A, but it's okay. You're not the only one.
I would just submit that this court should acknowledge the plain meaning of the statute and not proceed with any further inquiry. The statute in question means what it says and nothing more. It is unambiguous.
Could you address the state's argument that sexual conduct as it's defined in sub 2A connotes affirmative conduct? We also have a list that informs plain meaning. It says including but not limited to prior experience of sexual intercourse or sexual contact, use of contraceptives, living arrangement, and lifestyle. The state argues that all suggests affirmative acts of the witness, not inactivity.
I would go back to Gavigan, in which the court stated that the any evidence language, that nothing in the statute limits its applicability to prior affirmative acts. Rather, the plain meaning of the words prior sexual act include the lack of...
But that's kind of a conclusory statement of the court, with all due respect to my prior colleagues who may have written that. It's not really explaining or construing the language as to why the court adopted that construction.
I cannot guess at why the court engaged in that interpretation, but that is what it said at the time.
Okay. Let's say there was error. Just assuming, as we say, arguendo, that there is error. The state, of course, has a heavy burden in this kind of a case. They have to demonstrate that it's clear beyond a reasonable doubt that a rational jury would have found the defendant guilty absent the error. You heard your opposing counsel list the strong evidence. Tell me why they have not met the burden.
Well, I think that the court overestimates the strength of their case. Because I think they seem to have forgotten exactly how important Lisa's testimony was in the jury's eventual verdicts and when it was introduced, which was all after she'd already testified once. The DNA evidence comes in. Mulhern is not specifically identified. And now they're kind of, well, we need to go back and add a little more testimony here to fit with what we think the facts, the evidence suggests. So the only way they could do that was to ask her about any prior sexual contact within that 5-day frame. So I think that's much more important than the state would like to admit. The timing of that second testimony, the inadmissible testimony, I believe, of the in violation of the rape shield law.
Can you conceive of a group of facts under which the defense would be bolstered by inquiring of the victim's lack of past sexual activity? Lack of. I can understand the opposite, but can you think of a group of facts under which the defense would question the victim about lack of prior sexual activity or conduct?
I'm afraid I can't.
Yeah, I can't either.
Can I ask this in response? And that's I appreciate that question. What would does it come down more toward what the defense could do in response to such a question? I know that this Polizano has been put forward. I don't think I read this as a blanket kind of ability of a defendant to then respond to this type of testimony. So would that be the impact that would have on a defendant potentially?
Can we do that next?
Sure.
I'm just trying to figure. So I can't think. I've been sitting here kind of thinking about the many, many trials that I've had. I can't think of a time where the defense was better by questioning a victim about their lack of prior sexual activity. And the statute generally deals with what you can go into and what a victim is protected from, right? And then Polizano, sort of the balancing of constitutional rights and whether they open the door and whether or not you can have, you know, other questioning to sort of balance things out and make sure the full story is told. And I'm just trying to think of whether in any way a rape shield statute applies to that scenario. I can't think of a single time where that would somehow benefit the defense.
In all candor to the court, I can't. I'm sorry.
Can I ask you to consider the possibility of this, that the whole purpose for the rape shield law is so victims did no longer had to prove their virginity, which would be a lack of sexual activity, that's the whole reason we have this? Because back from the beginning of time, when men sexually assaulted women, women were not believed, and in order to even bring a claim, they had to prove their virginity. Isn't it possible that's how we get to 972.11 in the first place?
Anything is possible, Your Honor.
Okay, more questions.
Anyway, I don't know. I just was trying to noodle through that a little bit with you. Polizano then, let's say the defense had some evidence of sexual activity within that last week that would then go to the credibility of the witness that might be admissible under Polizano, but that wasn't approached at all. Was defense counsel faulty for not saying, hey, I know she was, and I want to go into this?
I would say it suggested he had no evidence. And if you don't have it, you don't have it.
You don't get it.
You can't make it up.
Okay.
Was this pre-trial? I thought this was at the trial.
Right.
So at the trial, for the first time, the defense is learning that she's going to testify to this information. How would he have known to go, that was even going to be a question asked?
Well, wasn't the DNA, didn't Discovery tell him that there was DNA evidence that was found from the same exam and that the DNA was of an unknown source?
Yes, I believe that's correct.
Well, he knew that pre-trial.
Right, but he can't put in the evidence pre-trial about her sexual activity under the rape shield. So even if he knew information that she had slept with someone else, how is he going to get that into evidence? He can't, right? I mean, is that part of the issue here that we're talking about? I know Justice Ziegler's question kind of went to that, but and so did Justice Rebecca Bradley's question about, well, does this kind of take us into an area where we're going to be second-guessing the rape shield? Isn't the purpose so that we're just not having these kind of discussions, that we're not allowing into evidence from either side, questions about virginity, which was the root of the rape shield law initially, and then some other questions about sexual conduct so that it doesn't devolve into an evidentiary determination by a circuit court judge of whether they're going to let that testimony in?
I agree. It's not admissible.
Well, yes and no. I mean, if someone goes down this road, then relevant cross-examination under Polizano could occur. But that would really go to this witness's credibility. It really is almost irrelevant whether she had sexual activity with anyone that week at all, because the issue for the jury was whether or not this defendant committed it. And there was inconclusive DNA evidence, but if they didn't believe her, they didn't believe her. And this testimony is not going to be relevant in any respect.
And so?
So, well, I mean, with all due respect, we have a lot of long questions that don't answer and with question
marks. I know.
I'd be happy to help you with that, too, Justice Bradley. But do you have any comment on that? I mean, why is this even relevant?
Because, well, without this testimony about that 5-day period,
the jury would be left with the physical evidence of the and the medical testing results and DNA that's inconclusive.
I just think the DNA might have been the tipper for the jury. State realized that could be. That's why they needed to get this in at the last minute.
Well, his DNA was his DNA in other places on her body?
They didn't. I don't believe on her. Maybe on her neck.
Right.
Yes.
On her neck.
Yes.
So his DNA is on her neck, but it's inconclusive when they did the vaginal testing.
Correct.
Okay. So that might actually work to the defense, right? I mean, they tested my DNA, they found it on my neck, you know.
If not for her, then testimony that, no, I didn't have any sex in the last 5 days.
Other than?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I would just also mention that in the state's argument, talking about the past decisions, not reason holdings carrying precedential value, citing a case that held that a concession for the sake of argument that the Supreme Court adopts without study discussion is not a holding worthy of precedential value. Well, I don't believe that the state has really provided any facts to support its claim that these past concessions over the last 40 years were merely for the sake of argument. It did not have to concede that this court's prior interpretation of the statute was correct and could have challenged it and engaged in a studied discussion, as it suggests, at any time since Gavigan and as recently as Bell, even. So I think that is not strong argument as the state might suggest to the court.
I think the state is asking us to take a look at the statute and actually analyze it, because it wasn't a central issue in Bell. It was a few sentences in Bell that was just going along with what prior cases had said. And Gavigan, again, I mean, I look back at it, and you summarized it almost word for word what the court had to say, which was actually very little. So I think, you know, it is valid for us to take a second look at it, and I find it a bit challenging to read it. You know, we can get into the purpose of the statute, as Justice Kurofsky, I think, was talking about, and I think she's absolutely right. But it seems that its application in this case is to exclude very relevant evidence and thereby converting the statute from a shield to protect the victim from undergoing an attack on her character. And it's turning it into a sword where she can't introduce relevant evidence, even when the defense would have the opportunity under Pulizano to rebut the evidence. So I do think it's valid, isn't it, for the court to take a look and actually, for the first time, I think, construe the language. And maybe we'll agree with your position, but there's nothing, I mean, I don't even know that stare decisis principles come into play here.
Well, most swords have two sides, and I think the reality is that Mr. Mulhern is just asking that it be used according to its plain meaning in this case, which can shield both the accuser and the accused under certain facts, such as in this case. Unless the court had any other questions, I don't think I have any more this morning.
I do, Mr. Schurz. I want to talk, I'd like to ask you a question about regarding harmless error. And before I do, I want to say that I know the Court of Appeals used the phrase he said, she said, and I know that you used it in your argument, and I thought that the state explained the problems with that phraseology, which is like the rape shield rule that came in to protect victims so that they didn't have to prove their virginity. There also used to be a rule that in order to bring a sexual assault claim, you had to have physical evidence or a witness. This was the rule at the founding of this country and even before, and it was sort of summed up as ladies lie. And so the idea was that if you had a situation where a victim was going to allege that she was sexually assaulted and the perpetrator said, I didn't do it, that they wouldn't look any further. And I think he said, she said at best is antiquated and at worst is just really, really is misogynistic. So I hope that we can get away from using that phrase, and as I noted, the Court of Appeals used it as well. Having said that, your argument against harmless error focused very much on the factual discrepancy between the parties. And you mentioned also the fact that the victim made statements to witnesses that was of little import. But you failed completely in your brief to analyze the crime scene in this case, which was the victim's body and the evidence from the sexual assault nurse exam. And it seems to me that that is a very, very strong and compelling part of the state's case. So I would like to give you the opportunity now to explain how we should consider that if we get to considering harmless error in this case.
Well, it's impossible to ignore the medical evidence, and I don't ignore it, but given the DNA evidence, inconclusive DNA evidence, there is still a chance that there's another explanation for what caused her injuries, aside from Mr. Mulhern committing it. The fact that he had no evidence of another encounter That doesn't mean that there might not have been. That's the only way I can answer that. I don't know. It just...
It doesn't... And that's reasonable doubt.
I think it could be, yes. I think without her testimony, there's a reasonable probability that the jury would have come back with a different verdict.
So let me, just to follow up on that, we still have the DNA evidence in. We still have the other physical evidence in, right? In our harmless, doing the harmless error approach. So I guess what would be before the jury? Be all the same physical evidence, the I told folks, you know, the day of, the day after, a few days later, I have all these physical, you know, all the physical injuries, those sorts of things. Obviously the testimony there. And the DNA evidence is still in. I guess without that testimony, maybe it becomes a bit less persuasive. And so your harmless error argument rests, it seems to me, I guess, entirely on the notion that the DNA evidence was sort of almost essential, because the absence of that being quite as persuasive doesn't necessarily cast doubt any of the other evidence, I guess, that's presented, right? It just leaves open the fact that there might be another explanation for this, but there was no argument that there was another explanation for it, and there probably wouldn't have been any vehicle for making an argument of another explanation for it either, precisely because of this statute, right?
Correct.
All right.
All right, then. Thank you.
Thank you for your time this morning.
So, in kind of in response to Justice Bradley's question about Gavigan, I think that's right. I mean, where the court says nothing in the language excludes this evidence, nothing in the language actually includes it either, I think. And based on their statutory interpretation of 2A, 2B, reading the whole statute together, the plain language of the statute doesn't include that language. And, you know, if...
Counsel, one of the things I just want to push back on is one of the arguments you made in your brief that I was struggling to understand a little bit is that, you know, this reading is consistent with the purpose by allowing this sort of evidence in. But it does seem like this opens up a victim in this situation to this kind of probing in every kind of case, you know, in... at some level. And so why isn't putting this evidence off limits part of the broader structure as well?
Well, I think this might go just sort of to the question that doesn't this open the door to more evidence coming in that wouldn't otherwise coming in? Is that what you're asking? Or
not just about evidence. It's about at least arguably the statute as it's been described, you know, is partially to take the victim's sexual activities and sexual life off the table for exploration.
Right.
And if you can use the evidence as long as the answer only goes one way and not the other, then the victim's sexual activity is most certainly on the table, depending on the answer to the question. And so it becomes fodder for investigation.
Sure. It also only comes in if it's relevant and if it's not unduly prejudicial. So it still isn't, it's not like, you know, if you said, okay, it doesn't include lack of sexual conduct, then it's like, okay, open season, it always comes in. It still has to pass relevancy. It still has to be not unduly prejudicial. You know, and I think this case really reflects the situation where it is relevant. I mean, we have this partial DNA result. It helps inform that result, essentially. That's really all it's doing. And so it has a really limited effect. But we go back to the purpose of the statute. It really wasn't to keep out evidence. It was designed to keep out evidence that would harass or humiliate the victim. It wasn't designed at this sort of thing. So, you know, maybe does it open the door to possibly other evidence that might... It might, and that's always been the case with
What if the evidence had been, you know, not What if the evidence, what if her answer had been, I did kiss, I did have some somewhat intimate time, but not any sexual relationship. How would that change the analysis? Is that admissible? Is that not admissible under your theory? Is that conduct relating to sexual activities?
If she said, I kissed someone, but not, I mean, I think.
I went to a party, I sat on a couch, and I was making out with somebody for a while.
Well, I think the question was, did you have sexual intercourse with anyone? So then that wouldn't be the answer. But I think, you know, keeping this evidence that of non-sexual, lack of sexual conduct out, though, I mean, it could be kind of taken to ridiculous levels. I mean, if the question was, did you have sex yesterday afternoon, and it was, no, I went to Starbucks, or no, I went to Starbucks, but I wrote about sexual desires. Well, actually, if they're just saying, implying that you didn't have sex because you're at Starbucks isn't Rape Shield evidence, is Rape Shield evidence under the current law, but then saying that you were writing about your sexual desires under Vonish isn't. I mean, it sort of becomes really, lack of sexual conduct is really all conduct that isn't sexual. So it could really kind of become problematic. I just wanted to read something from a case, out of state case from South Dakota, Pugh, in response to Justice Karofsky's points about the Rape Shield statute. This is paragraph 13. Chastity, as much as promiscuity, may characterize a person's sexual conduct so that, other things being equal, evidence of either would be inadmissible. Other things are not equal, however. The purpose of the Rape Shield law is not to bar people from vaunting their chastity or testifying to their loss of virginity, but to protect victims from the humiliation of having their unrelated sexual conduct paraded before juries.
So along those lines, and along the lines of Justice Hagedorn's question, we're assuming that a prosecutor is only going to ask questions that a victim wants them to ask. What if we're in a situation where there is an issue of chastity or virginity or not having sexual conduct, and we say that's okay from the prosecution? Aren't we subjecting victims potentially to those questions against their will still?
I'm out of time. May I answer the question?
Yes, you may.
Okay. I think the lesson here, too, is for prosecutors that they just need to use care in asking these questions and eliciting them. So I don't think the prosecutor would have asked the question here had the victim said, I don't want to answer that or I don't want to provide that information. I mean, I think it's just, again, I mean, this is, again, the typical, these are the questions prosecutors should be asking victims before trial about, you know, where they're going to go with their questions. So, thank you.
Thank you for your briefs and interesting oral arguments, answering our questions out here. The court will reconvene for the second oral argument when people are positioned for us to do so. Thank you.